Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Boy, it feels kind of empty around here. Hello, 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 hello. Nothing but an echo. That's because Jelaine Jordan has the night off. Remember, she was saying she was going up to the Michigan Women's Music Festival, and she's going to be back, and she had intended to, but she performed writes, and she's a singer-songwriter, and the people there were so impressed with her, they asked her to stay for sort of the grand finale and sing with some of the big bands. So she's, as we're talking, she may be singing to tens of thousands of women assembled at the Michigan Women's Music Festival. Actually, if you want to hear some of her music, I love her stuff, and we should play more of it. Yeah, she's too modest to be a performer. Yeah, you just got to be, what they always say, what's the word, like unabashed or unashamed, shameless self-promoter. That's right. That's the phrase. You got to be a shameless self-promoter. But if you go to my website, I'm shameless. You accept I'm not a singer-songwriter, and everything on my site is something pretty much that's been copied from elsewhere and all that. So it ain't me. I just like to what's on there is the information and graphics and announcements of events and stuff like that that's impressed me. So I'm just kind of passing it along to you. But it's Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. WERB.com. And there is an interview with Vice President Snarly done by Jay Leno. That's quite a hoot. You might want to see that. Also, there is a press conference featuring George W. where he is talking about zombies being the greatest danger to your children. That's right. But probably the most intriguing one and the one that has the most authenticity is the one in which Dick Cheney, you know, the Vice President Snarly, in 1994, warning about an Iraq quagmire and defending the fact that George Bush the First, King George the First, did not go into Baghdad, did not try to overthrow Saddam Hussein because he said it would be a quagmire. In fact, in 1994, this is astounding. Here is Dick Cheney warning against everything that he presided over. 9 years later. So I don't get it. He's character disintegration or something like that. Did I say, though, that if you go to my website, that you can go to Jolene's MySpace page, which is very cool. Got a lot of her music on there you can listen to and what have you. This is the Night Call program, usually with Jelaine Jordan. And this last week and a couple of days the week before, I substituted for Mike Malloy, a nationally syndicated talk show host on the Nova M radio network. And I know a number of you had emailed me. People were listening to the Mike Malloy show with me on it and saying, I'm really looking forward to you doing the show with Jelaine Jordan. Well, you'll have to wait till next week, I guess, because Jelaine is up there singing, right? The Michigan Women's Music Festival. 313-298-WRIF, and it's 313-298-9743. For the bashful, or if our lines are filled, which they are not right now, you can go to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And Night Call has a MySpace page as well. We're always looking for new friends. And Jolene takes care of that, so it'll be a bit before she answers you, I guess. But again, that's at Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Okay, let's go to the events of the week. And you join us, right, at 313-298-WRIF. Suddenly, all of this stuff about the collapse of the stock market, which even that phrase is pretty excitable, because there was quite a drop of hundreds and hundreds of points on the New York Stock Exchange Index. And some people are saying it's just a correction, whatever the hell that means. You know, you know what I think is emblematic of the world financial system is the shots that they show you on television of the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. So usually you think about these ultra-wealthy people, very calm and dignified, wearing their $2,000 suits and their $9,000 Rolexes and their $400 pairs of shoes, and talking in a very calm way. And yet, and of course, the ultra-wealthy are not on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, but the traders are, and it's just absolute bedlam, chaos, just unbelievable. And essentially, that is the nature of the economic system that we're all subjects of. We're not the people that are making the decisions. We move around little teeny weeny bits of stock in a 401k. I mean, and how many of us even are lucky enough to have that? But suddenly, all the talk about it has completely dropped. Or they're saying, oh, it happens many Augusts during, you know, there was the Asian crisis, and, well, there was a, I can't even follow it. I was trying to, you know, trying to make like I know what I was talking about when it comes to economics and finance. And I was trying to explain to my wife what was going on. She's, I can't understand a word you're saying. And I was putting it in the most simple terms possible. And I was thinking, I really don't understand any of this. I was just blowing smoke. And I don't know that anyone really does. I mean, they understand the internal mechanics of it because many of them have turned it all into profits for them. And how much of this is even real value? I don't know. We're starting to get into weird stuff. I mean, what is value? What is money? What is stock? What does it mean if you're worth $42 billion? It used to be that people actually had money, you know, actual money, and they had it in banks. So if you were worth, like, say, 100 years ago, $150,000, which was a hell of a lot of money then, it was actually in a bank. And you could go and take it out. Now, most of our money is just cyber representation. And some people, you know, say, oh, it's all got to be backed by gold. There's not enough gold in the world to back the amount necessary for international capitalism, you know, and all of the trading and what have you. People buy money. I mean, what is that? I mean, this is absolutely insane. And what happens? Who gets screwed? I mean, sometimes some of the biggies lose a bit and what have you, and once in a while some of them even crash dramatically, but usually it's the people towards the bottom of the pyramid. In fact, even beginning at the middle class, and the lower you are in the pyramid, the more apt you are to get stuck, right? So we'll see. Some people have even said, and we're not supposed to do this because you can tell it's not even based on real value or real worth because a lot of it is on the psychology of the market. Is there going to be, you know, like a panic and all these margins are going to be called in? I don't know. All right. I'm pretending like I know what I'm talking about again. But I know things aren't going well when you start looking at this. I saw this in the Detroit Free Press today. That no summer vacation for half of metro residents this year. 47% of adults in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County have neither taken nor plan to take a vacation this summer. You know, recreation, it's like recreation, right? We're supposed to recreate ourselves by getting leisure time to do what we wanted, to do nothing or paint the house or spend the time with the kids or what have you. The proportion of Metro Detroiters taking a break from vacations is consistent with national studies and polls that show Americans' vacation time, already among the shortest in the world, is dwindling. Now, what's up here? We're the wealthiest country in the world. We've gone at this a lot. And we used to say, I'm always thinking of those sporting events, and people are going, USA, number one, USA, number one. Well, except in those sporting events, where are we number one? Why are we number one in everything if we are People say, well, this is the greatest country in the world. Well, we're not the greatest country in the world in terms of vacation time, are we? I mean, people work their butts off here. And so what does this mean? That you get less vacation time and the ultra-rich are getting richer. It sounds like the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and there's a relationship there. That's what's so disturbing. A Gallup poll last summer found 43% of Americans had no plans for a summer vacation. More than half, 56% of American workers, don't use all their paid vacations, including 30% who use less than half of it. This is terrible. I mean, you think about the vacations that are based in law in Europe. I don't know about Canada. Some of our Canadian callers can tell us about that. A study published earlier by the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that nearly one quarter of private sector workers in the United States get no paid time off. So 25% of the workers don't get any time off. And that's why there's laws to say you have to give your workers time off. And I know this won't be a big surprise either. Most of them hold low-paying, small business or part-time jobs. In the Free Press Local 4 poll, two-thirds of the respondents who made less than $35,000 a year said they weren't planning a vacation this summer, compared to just 29% of those making at least $85,000 a year. So it's like 70% of the people that are in the upper echelons. That's just the middle class, too, right? The 85,000. But the median wage in this country is like $30,000. So 50% of the entire country and the wealthiest country in the world make $30,000 or less. And figure, if it's median, how do they do that? Is it just numerical? I can't remember exactly. It's not average. So if somebody's making $10 million and someone's making $1,000, no, that's the average. Okay. Don't start me with mathematics. So what's going to happen tomorrow? I've heard the phrase. Did I say that out loud yet? We're not supposed to speak negatively or pessimistically, because that might make the market crash. And I don't want that. You don't want that. Who knows what in the hell could happen? But I've heard the phrase Black Monday. Now, in 1929, wasn't it Black Friday? Yeah. Wasn't that when it all crashed? Well, this time around, the Federal Reserve System just said, hey, there's not any money for the biggies to borrow. We'll put up $38 billion. Here it is for you, $38 billion. Don't worry. So maybe they've cured it all, right? In the meantime, as you may know, when George W. Bush, after having stole the 2000 election, became president in January 2001, and promptly drove this country from being having a surplus, having taken in more money than actually the government needed or spent, to making us a debtor nation. Now, that's pretty good. Think about yourself doing that. Say that you were, had no debts whatsoever, and through a lot of bad mistakes like gambling and boozing. Actually, Joe Lewis, they asked him, he had made like $12 million, and that's an extraordinary amount for the 30s and the 40s. And it was gone. Some of you know Joe's history, that he wound up as like a greeter in Las Vegas. Very sad story. So they said, Joe, what happened to all your money? And he said, I spent it on women and booze and gambling and clothing. And he said, I wasted the rest. But George Bush, of course, has wasted the rest. Actually, he's given away the basis of financial stability by taking all these taxes off of the ultra wealthy. Whereas who needed the tax relief was you and me, but It was you and me. Because, let's see, John from Detroit said the median income in Michigan is $42,000 a year. Well, that's cool. That's good. That's accurate, but we got to. And I'm sort of surprised. John, send me something on that, will you? At calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The reason I say that is economically now Michigan is right down at the bottom in terms of economic statistics, and it used to be like another M state, Mississippi to some extent, Maine as well. So anyway, George Bush drives us into debt, and think again. Think about your dad. If you're younger, or remember when you lived at home, and your dad had savings in the bank, saying, yeah, we're going to have this for a rainy day. Maybe we'll buy a cottage up at Higgins Lake or something like that. And then all of a sudden, he started doing what Joe Louis did, started boozing and gambling, and suddenly that money's all gone, and there's nothing but credit card debts. And let's back up. There's no money in the bank, and then he starts maxing out on the credit card to pay the bills, to pay the fundamentals of the family's expenses. So, how was the analogy with George W. Bush? Well, he borrows money from China. Now, there's only one rival to the United States in the entire world, really, economically, and perhaps in some way down the line, somewhere down the line, unless policies change, militarily. But Bush has allowed the United States to become indebted to China and other Asian countries as well. But the biggest holder of U.S. debt is China. And so China has about $900 billion in a mix of U.S. bonds, and they're threatening to liquidate its vast holding of U.S. Treasury bonds if Washington tries to put sanctions on them for forcing a revaluation of their money. Who knows what weirdness this is all about, because the United States says that the Chinese yuan is overvalued. Don't ask. But this all affects us, ultimately. It all affects us because, as you know, there is the principle that maybe Dad, since he's just ruined the family finances, or in this case, George W. Bush, who has ruined the country's finances, on our credit cards, you could say, we only have to pay $25 on this thousands of dollars. But then what it keeps building up is the interest. So the debt service is accruing larger than anything we're paying down. So that's happening here as well. So who knows what's going to happen? We'll know tomorrow, won't we? All right. So that's one little aspect of it. If you'd like to comment on that, 313-298-WRIF. Now, the tragic situation out at the Crandall Canyon mine. I don't know how much of this... I always say I don't watch television. I don't watch the television news. Kind of think it's worthless. If I'm in the biz, if I thought it was important to watch, I'd watch CNN and Fox and CBS and ABC News all the time. Yeah, I don't get much. But when I'm doing talk shows, like I was substituting on that nationally syndicated show last week, I want to know what they're positioning as important news, because generally then people think that's what's important. Because that's what they talk about. And that's not necessarily going to talk about that, but at least I want to know what is coming into on a mass basis to the MSM, right, the mainstream media. Well, a lot of it has been about this tragedy at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. And it's normally thought of when mines like this happen. It's a disaster. Well, of course, it is a disaster. And the tragedy of... what happens to the families, and so often there's tradition within communities, but these are horrible jobs. These are absolutely horrible jobs, and only come about through the coercion of wages. It's not like somebody said, I got an idea. Do I want to be a lawyer or a teacher, or do I want to work in a coal mine? Obviously, that the pressure is in some communities to have a job that one can earn a living from, sends people down in the mines. Now, there's great struggles in the mine industry, particularly in places like Kentucky and West Virginia in the 1930s. A lot of union folk songs about that. And the mine owners have always been absolutely horrible. And they've also fought against safety regulations. And you can see what happens when it's completely unregulated, because the country with the absolute worst safety record around mines in the world is China, where there's thousands of people die. And they say, well, six people dying in a mine, that's good news, instead of like 600 or something like that. But it turns out that there's a real ugly side to this, besides just the tragic side to this Crandall Canyon mine. And like I said, I don't know whether this is coming out everywhere. I certainly didn't see it on ABC News when I was watching. But it turns out the president of the Utah mine, where the six miners are missing, has been extremely vocal against any regulation of the coal industry. And he called Senator Hillary Clinton anti-American for suggesting that the nation needed a president who was for worker safety. So get this piece of work. Turns out he's a far right-wing Republican. What a surprise, huh? His name's John Murray. I'm sorry, Robert Murray. Robert Murray is his name. He testified before Congress 2 months ago that his safety record with all his mines, and he owns quite a few of them. And again, you would think, here's a guy that is a multimillionaire. He owns all these mines. And why doesn't he open his heart to these people? Why wouldn't he like convene a committee of the miners? This is a joke, of course, because usually what happened back in the 1880s, 1890s, into the 1930s, the mine owners, this guy is nice compared to those people back then. They would shoot the miners down. They would shoot their children. They would shoot their wives. They would set up camps out in the West, Western Federation of Miners, and there were these massacres of whole families by the National Guard called up by the mine owners. Here in Michigan, in 1913, in Calumet, Michigan, there was the 1913, maybe that's what it was called, 1913 massacre up in Upper Michigan, the copper mines, where there was a strike by the United Mine Federation, or what was it called then? But anyway, and a goon from the bosses went into this party at Christmas time and yelled fire when there wasn't one, and a stampede occurred, and I think it was about 75 people were trampled to death, including about 50 children. So this is the history of the mines, who they fought tenaciously against any regulation, because regulations cost them money. And they don't give a damn about the people that are working for them. Or, like I said, they would convene a committee of miners and say, what do you need to make this safe? Tell me what you need to make this safe. I don't want to make a lot of money off of your dead bodies. Robert Murray does, though. He testified before Congress that his safety record with all his mines, quote, is one of the best in the coal industry anywhere. In a testy exchange with Senator Barbara Boxer, Murray said a story reporting two of his Ohio mines showed injury rates a fourth higher than the national average. He said it was propaganda. And the Mine Safety and Health Administration has cited Murray's, here's the truth of it, has cited Robert Murray's mines in central Utah with more than 300 violations since January 2004, including 118 significant and substantial violations that are considered serious enough to cause injury or death. Murray, who testified against regulation of the energy industry as part of an effort to combat global warming, said changes to the coal industry would cause loss of high-paying mining jobs and be extremely destructive. He doesn't believe in global warming. He says, I resent politicians playing politics with my employees' safety. Sounds like the other way around, doesn't it? In 2003, Ken American Resources, a company owned by Murray, was convicted of violating mine safety laws at a Kentucky mine, and the company was fined $306,000. And you got to remember, this is, in terms of mine safety, at the mine safety, what is this, Mine Safety and Health Administration, these are Bush operatives in there. These are the people that he appointed the head of it, were these foxes to guard the chicken coop. And they've reversed a lot of mine safety regulations. But still, they're finding this guy. I mean, this is how bad he's got to be. Murray backs his political beliefs with his pocketbook. He's contributed more than $213,000 to Republican candidates over the last decade. Three political action committees tied to Murray's businesses gave $750,000 to Republican candidates and causes. Now, why would he do this? Is it an investment in good government? No. He wants less regulations on mine safety. This is Murder Incorporated. Wow. And it goes on and on. Whack job this guy is. You see him on television? 313-298-WRIF is our, I'm just hesitating. I have one more story, but I'm going to let it go. All right, so the two things is, one, and hey, we're all ADD on this bus, so anything you want to bring up is fine. Peter Werby here on Night Call, Jalene Jordan off for the night. 313-298-WRIF, and let's take some calls right now. Here's Randy in Auburn Hills. Randy, hi, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Part of the fairness doctrine, I wanted to say a little bit unslanted views. You talk about the mining industry. I wonder what you feel about Al Gore's zinc mining and leaving toxic waste and all the pollution that he left in his wake, and how much money did he make out of his zinc mine?
I have no idea. I'm the first I've ever heard of this, and would it surprise me that that some ultra-wealthy politician also had a dark side? Of course it wouldn't. What does that tell us, though? They're all corrupt, or Bush is corrupt as Gore, or the Republicans are as bad as the Democrats? What's the point?
Well, what you portray is socialist, communistic,
anarchistic. Folks, wait a minute, folks. I want to tell you, by the way, that this is not a archive show like from the 1980s or something. Randy is talking here in the 21st century, telling me I sound socialistic and communistic. Actually, Randy, I'm much, much more radical than that. But if you want to portray me like that, that's okay.
Well, you are. You're a socialist, correct?
No.
Well, what
is a socialist? Well, tell me what a socialist is.
Progressive.
I don't need it. You know what? All isms are wasms, my friend. And what we have to do is see what works for the majority of the people living on a peaceful, environmentally sound planet. The rest of it is all a lot of crap and ideology.
In a dictatorship, you're forced in a mind. In America, you choose to...
You don't understand the way it goes. You think people choose among all of the incomes that are available, all the job categories that are available. People take what's available within their class strata. We live in essentially in a caste system. There are people, again, there's been a lot of millionaires, but, you know, in the thousands made under the Bush racket. And there is a tiny bit of class mobility. But in the main, if you're working class, you stay working class. If your parents worked in an auto factory, same with you. If your parents were a lawyer or a doctor, same thing. That's the way it is. And it's empirically so. It's sociologically correct. But tell me what a socialist is.
Well, in the dictatorship throughout all other countries in the world, you're forced to work in a mine.
Oh, listen, I ask you what I ask you what socialism is or a socialist is, and you tell me in dictatorships they force you to work in mines. I don't want to force anybody to do anything. People in this society are forced to do things, and like forced to live without health care, for instance. But let me ask you one more time, since you said I was a socialist and a communist, what is a socialist?
Support Venezuela, and he's taken over. He's a dictator.
So wait a minute. So... that's what a socialist is, somebody that supports Venezuela, huh?
Yeah, that's why.
So if you look up in a dictionary and you look up socialist, it'll say someone who supports Venezuela.
Down there, didn't you?
I hate to say it, Randy, you're an idiot. I rarely call names, but things like this have such a lack of benefit in public discussion, because we could talk about what is socialism, what is communism, what is social democracy, what is enlightened capitalism like exists in Canada and Sweden and what have you. I went to Venezuela. I don't support any government, and I've written stuff critical of Hugo Chavez, as a matter of fact.
No, that's not the way you portrayed it.
Well, reason I do is because usually I wind up talking to people like you. Overall, he has an elected government. He maintains 70% of popularity for among his people. He has done something that now it's starting, of course, that these client states of the United States that simply looted their own population for their own riches and to let the rest of it go up to the big corporations up in here in the United States. He's stopped that, and he has started programs with the oil wealth that he has, rather than enriching their executives, has been spread to the poor. And I was in that country. It's embarrassing to be a North American and see the level of poverty that's still there. I don't even know if they're capable of ending poverty in Venezuela. It is so endemic. What?
Maybe they should get a job in a coal mine.
You know, you are an idiot. Have a nice night. Don't call back. Okay, because you disable conversations. You don't help them. I mean, I'm willing to look at these definitions and examine these policies, how they function historically and what the problems with them are, what the problems are with Venezuela, why I'm critical in aspects of Venezuela and what have you. But these are, you know, people like him, I don't even understand. I don't get it. But whatever. What's a socialist? Somebody that supports Venezuela. I see. Okay. Let's go to Jim in Lake Orion. Jim, it's Peter on WRIF. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
Good evening, Peter. That last caller sounded like a Mark Levin fan. And, you know, I'm not...
I don't even know who that is.
Mark Levin?
Yeah.
Oh, he's another Bush supporter. He's got our show on the...
Wait. You know what you're doing, Jim? One of the things I do, why give people like that any publicity? The media, the media is dominated by right-wingers. And, you know, I always say, deal them the cruelest blow of all.
Well, I...
Ignore them.
I do, but, you know, I'm just saying, he's just... He reminds me of a person like that. But
yeah.
Anyway, I want to talk about the Medicare problem we have here.
Sure.
I am on Social Security. It's a non-duty disability. Now, they tell you Medicare has to be your primary carrier.
Okay.
So I sign up for Medicare, and they tell me, well, you didn't sign up for it when you were supposed to, so you get penalized 10% for every year that you didn't sign up for it. Now, the thing is, you cannot go to a doctor and depend on Medicare to pay for all your doctors. Medicare says it's always best to have supplemental insurance. And yet they charge you a fortune for the Medicare premium.
Sure.
Now, I read the history of Medicare when it was first offered. It didn't cost anything.
Right.
It was a benefit for the senior citizens. And through the years, each president from Nixon on down has destroyed Medicare. You know, they've made it, and Reagan said, well, I can't see why we government should be giving it away. People should pay for it.
Yikes. Well, here's where it all went. By a vote, where's the vote in here? 395-13, which means both parties just provided $500 billion for next year's war budget for the Pentagon. And that doesn't even include what Bush wants for another $147 billion in Iraq war funds. So what we're talking about here is the military-industrial complex takes away from us, the American people, everything that is given to other industrial nations as a matter of right. A full paid medical health program. Now, the United States, again, number one. Where are we number one? 7 years ago, the World Health Organization ranked the health systems of the 191 nations. France and Italy took the top two spots. United States, a dismal 37. Where's number one? Why aren't we number one? All right, let me take a break and I'll be right back. Jim, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you brought that up. And our phone number, 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, off for the night.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Listening WRIF.com.
fell.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Did he say that? No. I said that. 313-298-WRIF. Jolene offered the night. We've been talking about the stock market crashing somewhat. We'll see tomorrow. Will it be Black Monday, as some people have said? In fact, that mine safety is dismal in this country. It's not as dismal as China. We're not losing thousands, but the Republicans certainly go out of their way to limit regulation as much as possible, and the head of the Crandall Canyon Mine turns out to be a right-wing Bush supporter who doesn't want any regulations. So, and what else? Wasn't there? Oh, yeah, the medical system. And we're talking about, why are we number one? Why are we number one in everything instead of like 30s and 40s down in so many things that are important to us? Dennis, or Denis, if it was in Montreal, it'd be Denis, but could be Dennis, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. When you write, put what city? Because if you said Montreal, I would say my terrible French. With this panic, with this economic financial panic on now, we seem to take it for granted that the government or the Federal Reserve Bank will help out. He says, I'm not sure who owns who here. Will help out the big financial firms survive if things get tough. They've already they've put in $38 billion over last week to make sure that things really don't go down the crapper, right? But Dennis asks, why is it taken for granted that the little guys who may have made bad decisions, just like the banks, or been laid off or gotten ill and can't meet the mortgage payments anymore, well, they are just foreclosed on and lose whatever equity they accumulated in their home? Might it not be smarter to find some way to aid the bottom of the pyramid to avoid this crisis rather than just help out the wealthy? Well, for sure. If you're ringing right now, stay on there, and Slayer will get you in just a minute. He has his hands filled. Well, next time you hear some of these conservatives talk about the free market, just laugh at them. I mean, there really never has been a free market. And the thing that they really want free markets in are our wages, which would be driven down dramatically if there weren't laws about minimum wage, which is pretty pathetic, or particularly the unions, which they hate because unions drive the price of labor up. So they want labor in a free market. They want prices in a free market. They want to be able to rise them as much as possible. And they want a free market in profits as much. But everything else they want strictly controlled. So when they start to get in trouble, they can get $38 billion from the federal government and or through the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, which is not part of the government per se. But the free market is just an absolute bad joke. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF, and here's Alan Ingster. Al, it's Peter on WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
I believe that was the Italian Hall massacre you were talking
That's
about.
That's right. The Italian Hall massacre. I think in Calumet in 1913.
Oh, Calumet, my bad.
Yeah.
I've got friends, Finnish friends from Calumet. My bad. They'll be calling me. The other thing I want to talk about is the United Mine Workers and the mine struggles. You were talking about it like it happened in the 30s. It's happened as recently as the late 70s and the early 80s when they went on strike and against various mining companies, and the mining companies used gun thugs and assassination and intimidation.
Sure.
And it got so bad that somebody challenged the establishment candidate for the presidency of the United Mine Workers, and they sent company thugs in to massacre him and his family. I believe the guy's name was Jablonski.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten about that. There is just an ugly history on the part of mine owners and the kind of sacrifice, because coal provides the most energy for us. And these people are saints that are, most work is bad enough, but the idea of having...
Coal mining is evil.
Yeah.
You have never been dirty until you've gone. You don't even have to work. I just visited a coal mine one time in my life. And so I'm glad my relatives, when they had to make that choice, that right winger was taught, that chowder head, they had a choice of the coal mines or the army, and they went into the army. I was damn glad they did, because I ended up here in Michigan.
All right. Thank you, Al. I appreciate it. Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, it's Peter on WRIF. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Now, originally I was calling to tell you that, the mine industry pretty much wrote the safety standards, much like the pharmaceutical companies wrote the bill for the Medicaid pharmaceuticals, barring the government from doing things like negotiating prices.
Sure.
But that was up until Randy called,
mm-hmm.
And you're right, he is an idiot, and unfortunately there's a lot of blue-collar folks around here that would continue to vote against their...
Well, we don't know that he was blue collar. He's from Auburn Hills. And,
okay. I stand corrected.
Yeah.
But you know something? Now, if he had been fairly observant over the last few weeks, he would have seen a couple of documentaries. One called Commanding Heights.
Okay.
And it dealt with central planning versus free markets. And then a second documentary, both of these on TV Ontario. The other one called Corporations, or The Corporations.
Oh, yeah.
That's
a good one. I saw a friend of mine is in that, actually, at one point.
He would have learned a little something about the business world and how, multinationals, they owe no allegiance to their home bases, the countries that they were born in anymore.
Fred?
It's all about the bottom line.
But let me tell you something about a person like that. You and I could sit down. Say we found some aspects of our conversation talking about politics or philosophy or economics that we disagreed with. And I suspect from listening to you, and you've called before, is that you would listen to me and I would challenge your beliefs, and you would either refute them but you would think about them. These guys, they're never going to change their mind. That's why I talk to these people that participate in these right-wing blogs, or they listen to Fox News or something. It's hopeless.
They're the goose steppers.
They are. They're the third. They're the third of the country that voted for Hitler in 1932. You people say, how can anybody vote for Hitler? Well, only a third of the German people voted for him in the last free election, and a third of the country likes to listen to those far right wing talk shows. And when it always pops up, and Bush has got what's his popularity down to a little less than a third. He's even lost some of the upper edges of that fascist third. But they're there, they're there, and there's nothing you can say to them. I mean, imagine one of the things here, when you go to talk show school, Fred, which I didn't go, they say never ask a caller a question because you cede the microphone to him or her.
Right.
And instead, I said, what's a socialist? And he said, you know, you went to Venezuela. Well, I don't know. You know, I went to, I went to Canada, too. I don't know what that makes me. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Thanks for having joined me. Let me see where we are going from here. All right, let me do this instead. Here's another news item, the thing I was going to get to. I can't even think of his name suddenly. Mitt. That's right. Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney has walked away with the first prize of the campaign. It's the Iowa Straw Poll. Again, there's certain things that are not worth my, in my estimation. You can do what you want, but even considering like what's going on with all that, I mean, it is such a load of royal crapperoo that it doesn't. But there was something going on. It was part carnival, part political event, and he won. He got 32% of the vote. And then Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, came in second with 18, and Sam Brownback of Kansas. Now, those guys are both whack jobs, to be sure. Let's see. John McCain didn't compete in the contest. And Romney said, just after the vote was announced, I'm pleased as punch that I won. How long has it been since you've heard anybody say, I was pleased as punch? I predict that Mitt Romney will be the Republican candidate for president. But get this. This came in last week. I don't know how many of you saw this. Here, this is from the Associated Press. Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney on Wednesday defended his five sons' decision not to enlist in the military. So he's got five sons. He supports the war. Just like typical chicken hawk, right? They and you can, if you want a list of Republican chicken hawks, it's every single one of them. I don't know. They should have the ones that actually served in combat. Then that would be very teeny weeny little ones of prominent Republicans, right? But if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, you'll see this link. The link was down for a while, but now, I mean, it's astounding. It's astounding how these guys scammed out. The older ones, of course, scammed out of Vietnam. They all supported it, but they wanted the working class, the white working class, to fight it. They wanted minorities to fight it. They wanted to root people on from the sidelines. The guy I substituted for, Mike Malloy, his signature line is, if I told you tonight how much I hate these people, they're such frauds. They bring such evil and misery into the world. Life is hard enough for people. It always has been. And these are people like that guy that called in that that makes things even more difficult. In fact, by a factor of I don't know what. So anyway, Romney defended his five sons' decision not to enlist in the military. Well, why the hell should they? They're rich. Rich people don't join the military. Or if they do, they could wind up getting killed by their own men, like Pat Tillman, right? But here's what he said. He defended his five sons' decision not to enlist in the military, saying, they're showing their support. You are not going to believe this. They're showing their support for the country by helping me get elected. So the people we know, the people I know, the people you know, they're in Iraq. They're in Afghanistan. They're coming home with hideous wounds. They're being killed before a lie that Bush perpetrated. And Romney's five sons, in a war that he says is crucial, they're showing their support for the country by, quote, helping me get elected. Romney, who did not serve in Vietnam due to his Mormon missionary work, oh, man, was asked the question by an anti-war activist after a speech. How did they let her in? The good news, he says, is that we have a volunteer army, and that's the way we're going to keep it. Well, what the hell? You've got, and we'll talk a little later about how they get people in the army these days. My sons are all adults, and they've made decisions about their careers, and they've chosen not to serve in the military in active duty, and I respect their decision. Well, the United States Army is becoming increasingly a mercenary army, there is this awful mercenary component to the U.S. troops, like Blackwater and some of these other ones that are these high-paid killers for money. But still, when we're bribing people anywhere from $20,000 to $45,000, mercenary, think what the word means. But he added, one of the ways my sons are showing support for our nation is helping me get elected because they think I'd be a great president. As we said earlier, Romney said after winning the Iowa straw poll, "I'm pleased as punch that I win," and I'll bet that his sons were pleased as punch as well. The woman who asked the question, Rachel Griffiths, who they said was an anti-war activist, identified herself as a member of Quad City Progressive Action for the Common Good, as well as a sister of an Army major who had served in Iraq. Well, I guess that gives her some creds, doesn't it? He has zero. They asked if she was satisfied with Romney's answer. Of course not. He told me the way his son shows support for our military and our nation is to buy a Winnebago and ride across Iowa and help him get elected. All right, so a little, we're not going away. This is just a few lines of a song by my pal David Rovics.
The draft is coming. It's blowing down the door, so pack your bags, boys and girls. We're all going off to war. You can be the next to die for Halliburton. Hold the cord, drape the flag, and draw the curtain. You can pull the trigger for the Exxon Corporation. Watch the cities burn around you while you're standing at your station. You can shoot the children as they throw stones at your Humvee. You can die for Kerry or maybe for Dick Cheney. The draft is coming.
That's David Rovics, his song "The Draft is Coming." That was a few years ago. He mentions Kerry in there. Remember, Kerry was going to do the war better. Right? That was it. He wasn't saying get out of Iraq. He was saying we could do it better. Well, he couldn't do it worse than Bushco, the racket posing as a government is doing. But anyway, the reason I play that is hope some of you have heard this. Frequent tours for U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan have stressed the all-volunteer force and made it worth considering a return to a military draft, President Bush's new war advisor said Friday. Army Lieutenant General Douglas Lute said, "I think it makes some sense to certainly consider it." And one of the ways, I mean, I'm sure that if you're between, well, actually you can go in now to your 42. What modern nation in the last 100 years had people that old in their military? Not a nice comparison. But here's what I would think. Anybody that supports this war, I mean, I know there's not very many of you left, but if you all would join, then these other young people wouldn't get drafted. So I think you have some obligation, if you support this hideous war in Iraq, that you go join immediately, right? And take the pressure off the people that are in there that don't support. The majority of troops now want out. Majority of Iraqi people want us out. The majority of American people want. It is just these monsters at the helm that got us into this war for oil based on a lie that want to continue this. All right, let's pick up. Actually, Josh is calling from West Bloomfield. Josh, you ready for the draft?
I don't want to be, but I think I'll go if I get drafted.
Okay. Okay.
What? I'm sorry?
You think that's a good idea?
No. I was actually vacationing this weekend, and I just got back a few hours back.
Hey, you know what? I gotta put you on hold. So in fact, I don't think it did put you on hold, did it? But just stay there with me because I got to do this break before midnight. I'll break right back to get you, and we can start all over.
The pictures, the podcast, the blog,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super freaking cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
WRIN.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to our broadcast, the second hour, without Jalene Jordan. She's at the Women's, what is it? Why can't I? I've said it about 15 times. Michigan Women's Music Festival. That's right. Starts with Michigan. She'll be back next week at 1 a.m. Eastern time. If you're somewhere else in the country or around the world, you can easily do the math. I ought to give it in Greenwich time. You listen to the BBC, and what do they say? It's we're like something like four, you know, daylight savings time really screws it up. But we're like minus five Greenwich time. So, never mind. Forget about all that. 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of interviews, beginning with Monique Hardin. She's a New Orleans advocate for environmental human rights, and coming up on 2 years of another one of Bush's disasters. The first one, 9/11. Second one, being Katrina. Third, the economy. It just goes on and on, doesn't it? And then Henry Picotto. How do you say his name? Picotto, I think it was. Yeah. He is the chair of an organization called Jewish Voice for Peace. So he's going to talk about the Middle East. But all of that, I think, pretty interesting. Recorded it earlier this week. All right, let's go back to Josh. Josh is in West Bloomfield, and we were talking about the draft. He was saying that a Bush war advisor says that look, the Army, the all-volunteer volunteer force, is beginning to get pretty stressed. In fact, you know, Democrats introducing a bill that that GIs have to have as long a time off as they have served. And Bush says he's going to veto. Throw them. Send them back into the meat grinder. Right? I don't know if he says that exactly. But let's go back to Josh. Josh, hi. You're on the air again.
Okay. I'm pleased as punch to be here, Peter.
Okay.
I just want to say I'm 15 years old.
Yeah.
And listen to your show every week. And this weekend, my family went on a little vacation, and we were in Stevensville. I don't know if you know where it is. It's by Lake Michigan.
Okay.
And in the lobby on the TV, Fox News was on. And it was the old fart from the mine, that right-wing idiot who was talking about how he didn't want miners' rights. So I wasn't paying attention because I don't want to listen to him. But something caught my eye on the ticker, and it says, Bush advisor suggests return to military draft.
Yeah, that's the story we were talking about. Right.
And I'm 15, so like by the time that this thing happens, you know, I'm going to be right in the thick of this. And so I'm thinking, you know, I don't want to go to a war that is based on lies and that Bush is fighting for oil, that, you know, I don't want to fight for a war that's not going anywhere.
Yeah,
I don't want to be part of that.
It isn't going anywhere. Well, here is the problem, though. Now, in today's New York Times, actually by 3 minutes shy of yesterday, the Democrats say leaving Iraq may take years. And it is. I mean, you know, we use this phrase quagmire, and an actual quagmire is something you get stuck in. I mean, like mud and sand and what have you. But Bush, has genuinely driven us into a quagmire. So if somebody says, all right, let's get out as soon as possible. I mean, if we were going to leave everything there and get everybody on big transport planes and just fly them out real quick, maybe you could do it, but that's not the way you can retreat. And that's billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars of equipment. So even if we arrange to stop, you know, create an armistice to stop being one of the belligerents in the civil war that actually fights on both sides, we make friends with Sunnis and we arm Sunnis, which then fight Shiites. And then we also support the Shiite government, which is allied with Iran, that fights us and fights the Sunnis. I mean, it is the most impossible situation. I mean, you could not engineer if you set out to do this. I mean, it's only through incompetence and malice that and lies, as you said, Josh, that Bush was able to get us into this. All right, well, thank you, and I hope that people that are older than 15 and people that are 15 and younger understand the gravity of this and work to make sure that by the time you get to an age that we've entered an era of peace. I have to say I'm not real optimistic, though. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to John in Livonia. John's been waiting patiently for quite a while. Thanks for joining me, John. You're on the air.
Yes, Pete. Thanks for taking my call. I'm one of the people that is not going to be taking a vacation this year based on the oil prices.
Right.
I have a friend I visited in Tennessee, and I went three times the last 2 years, but it's expensive to drive, you know, and if your car only gets like 25 miles to the gallon, it seems like every time you turn around, you're filling up.
That is, I've got a full-size car, and what did I fill, like $45 or something like that? And that's only 15 gallons, right?
Yes. One more thing. I thought socialism was everybody's the same, that the redistribution of wealth, like it is in, not say, in Russia, where 2% have all the wealth and 98% just don't.
Yeah, well, that is one of the definitions of socialism, right? That wealth, the wealth of a nation is socialized in the sense that it's available to everyone. I mean, socialism as practiced in the real world didn't turn out to be a very good experiment. And some people say that wasn't even socialism. Essentially, what it was state capitalism, is that the state became the entrepreneur, the employer, and acted the way employers do when they're given a free rein. That is real cruelly. All right, thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. One of the things, of course, about the gas prices, the people that control things and that are making a fortune off of gouging us, they look to see what is our response, and our response isn't too great, is it? I haven't heard people complaining very much about it. And so look for it to start edging up a bit. It'll drop probably, you know, election time, but they'll probably, you know, something will happen and they'll say, oh, we got to charge you $5 a gallon, you know, and then they'll make this other fortune. And then when it comes down to around election time, Bush's Saudi buddies will certainly crank out the production, what have you. All right, here's Jay in Lincoln Park. Jay, it's Peter Werbe on WRIF. Thanks for joining me. You're on the air.
Thank you, Peter. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
Yes, I wanted to go back to the coal mine tragedy in Utah.
Please.
When it first happened, I got to thinking about back the last tragedy we had not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't understand why there wasn't changes done before that, or the changes didn't get incorporated sooner.
Right.
Because I think it's one of the most dangerous jobs you can ever have. That's, wow.
Absolutely.
Wow. And I just wanted to ask you a question. It reminded me of, like, in the turn of the century, the robber barons.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Rockefellers and all that. And they were doing that back then. It's like history repeating itself, as far as corporations basically can write their own rules. How can that be possible at this day and age?
Well, I don't know. And think about this. Think about almost now 150 years of industrialism and the struggle of ordinary people to have a decent standard of living, safe working conditions, a standard of life that brings you some leisure time. I mean, the bosses had the cops and the National Guard shooting people down in private guards, shooting people down in the street because, hey, we wanted to work 8 hours, or we wanted to have unions, or fill in the blank. I can't even begin to tell you, because I don't know for sure, but the hundreds and hundreds, I'm sure thousands of people that were murdered by the state apparatus that acted on behest of employers throughout this country over the last 150 years. And now, what are we doing? We're starting to head back that way. You're absolutely right, Jay. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Sarah. Sarah's in Detroit. Sarah, thanks for joining me on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
I really enjoy your program.
Well, thanks. I enjoy doing it.
Yes. I was wondering about national health care. Is that a good topic right now?
Absolutely. Well, we were talking some about it and why the United States is like 47th in the world ranked in terms of health care.
Exactly. And the thing that I have heard about it, from what I understand, Canada has it, right?
Canada, like all other industrialized countries, has a national health program where there's a single payer, which is the government, and you don't pay anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen Sicko, Sarah, I highly recommend it.
I haven't.
It's worth a look.
Okay, goes to the top of my list then.
Okay, better than The Simpsons, which I saw last night.
The Simpsons as well?
No. It depends if you're a big Simpsons fan. It was like watching 6 Simpson episodes in a row. I could have seen about a half an hour of it.
But, you know, with that health care, that national health care, I was wondering, is there any validity to the excessive bureaucratic red tape that some of the people are saying that is associated with it, such as the long lines for surgery and testing and emergency medical.
I mean, overwhelmingly, the people that we are most conversant with, like the Canadians, the English, the French, they're very satisfied with it. Do they have complaints?
Okay. I am sure.
Is it a bureaucracy is any administrative organization that, rather than the other word, is like convivial. Convivial is within your family. I mean, if I'm like your nephew or your brother, and I come to you, Sarah, and I say my arm's hurt. You don't say you got to fill out a paper, right? You say, "Whoa, let me get a bandage."
Right.
Right. So yeah, it's bureaucratic by definition, but our jobs are bureaucratic. And I'll tell you, one of the things that happens, like in Canada, to the extent that there are problems with the system, is that it's underfunded. And now you have this guy, Stephen Harper, who's a conservative and the prime minister, and he says he's going to build all these new ships so they can go up, since there's global warming and the Arctic ice is melting, he wants to go up there and claim the open waters above Canada as Canadian waters. So they want to spend all this money on increasing the Canadian army so they can go to Afghanistan. Well, I would say, I've said this before, and sometimes Canadians are horrified, but Canadians ought to abolish their army, have just like a national, like they have the Mounties already. Costa Rica doesn't have an army, for instance, and the only country that's going to invade Canada is the United States, and Canada couldn't stand up to that. So they might as well take all this money, the billions they're now spending on having a national army, and apply it to things that help the people. Having an army by the nation of Canada does nothing for them. But then there's like this national part. What do you mean we won't have an army? Screw that. I mean, what we want is what's good for us, for our communities, for our families. And having an army that essentially just sucks billions out of the potential for making a country as great as it should is not a good idea. And the worst example is the old United States of America, which spends trillions on preparations for war, more and more exotic weapons in space and all sorts of systems to do this and that. And as it stands now, we have an army that can't beat irregular guerrillas. So what's up with that? So, yeah, where should we be spending our money? We make the money. We pay all this, which is then looted, essentially, from us. Our wealth is looted. It goes through the government. It's given to these big military-industrial complex companies. All right, Sarah, thank you very much. Let's see. Here is get this thing to work. Here's Frank in Flint. Frank, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good.
Well, I'm just calling. I enlisted in the Army about 2 years ago, and just kind of wanted to mention some of the reasons that people have enlisted and a lot of my peers and that sort of thing, from my perspective at least.
Sure.
What exactly seems to be going on in soldiers' heads.
Okay.
It seems to me, obviously the reason, primary reason is the focus on college and bettering yourself in general. You can see that a lot with, like, the new campaign, the whole Army Strong deal. But a lot of it they don't seem to come forward. They're part of the deal, especially pushing for, like, Reserve and National Guard enlistments. I enlisted in the Reserves, and it just seems really odd to me, I was told I was put in the critical job field, that I get all this extra stuff, which I really hadn't seen.
Mm-hmm.
I signed a contract saying it was there, but now that I'm done with all my training and everything, there's no one really there to help you out with it, that sort of thing. Almost like a bait and switch. I suppose, there's a lot of things too, reasons for enlisting. I guess if I listen to Bill O'Reilly, it's because I'm a patriot and support the war on terror and, all that wonderful stuff. I guess I just didn't read up on, past history.
Well, think about this, Frank. What I was saying earlier, rather than spending these hundreds of billions and up into the trillions now, is that all universities, as they should be in this country, were free. And that the kind of training that now people have to trade off the risk of going into an army, fighting in a war that is, you know, everyone knows is ending. It's what John Kerry said about Vietnam. Who's going to be the last man to die for this war in Iraq? That's not going to come to any conclusion. It's going to...
Right. Well, oh, I agree entirely. And actually, I think, you know, you kind of touched on a point there that I don't think a lot of people have pointed to, but the education in this country is in shackles, but I mean just, you know, shambles. But, you know, there seems to be a lot of issues with people, just lack of education. You know, like you're talking to that gentleman earlier about the definition of socialism, and, you know, same thing if you throw around a word like fascism, especially being from a liberal perspective, people automatically think you just called them a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not realizing that there's a lot broader sense of it. And, you know, really, if we looked back in the past a bit more, you know, we would have maybe taken a few things. Like, you know, I remember a famous quote out there that goes something like, "The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them that they are in danger of being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger." Well,
yeah.
That was said by Hermann Göring.
Right, right. And that's that is the deal. That is right. Actually the deal.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, people ask a lot of questions like, why is all this happening? And I think it really goes back to the education. I mean, people know that socialism is bad because they went to government class in high school and they were taught just that. You know, they went over social contract theory and they know the name Locke, but they can't associate that with our current situation. You know?
Well, I wouldn't say socialism is bad. Dictatorship is bad. Police state is bad. And there's capitalist police states. There's socialist police states. We don't want any socialist police state, right?
Well,
because if you lived in Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia, on one hand, Hitler was acting solely in the behest of the big capitalists, and had a fake program of, you know, said he was for the people and all that, and Stalin was for the proletariat, for the worker, and there wasn't a capitalist class per se. But if you lived in either of those countries and you made a little squeak of protest, I guess it really wouldn't matter to you what they called it. What the operating and defining aspect of those governments, of course, was its police state aspect.
Well, I didn't mean to point a finger at socialism saying that it is bad, but what I was just trying to point out was the fact that that's what people are pretty much taught in a government class nowadays. Yeah, obviously people don't even understand that there's a, you know, whether or not you're going from a rightist capitalist point of view or a very leftist, and there's such a broad plethora of things you can pick out, you know, like you mentioned earlier, a nice long list. But it stops a Democrat, and anything else is crazy liberal like Yahoo, but I digress. Point was is that a totalitarian or militaristic regime has nothing to do with political views anyways. It's a separate spectrum, I suppose to say. But the critical thinking just isn't there.
Well, that's the key. Critical thinking, and that's what is lacking, I'd say, on those people on the right. All right, Frank, best of luck. You know, hope you stay safe. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. On my website, which you can either, if you want to just Google this, you can Google Britt, B-R-I-T-T, because this is the name of a college professor, political science. Lawrence Britt wrote the 14 characteristics of fascism in an article in Inquiry magazine, Free Inquiry magazine, rather, in the spring 2003. And here are the 14, I'm not going to read all 14 elements. Powerful and continuing nationalism, disdain for the recognition of human rights, identification of enemy scapegoats as a unifying cause, supremacy of the military, controlled mass media, obsession with national security, religion and government intertwine, corporate power protected, labor power suppressed, disdain for the intellectuals and the arts, obsession with crime and punishment, rampant cronyism and corruption, and fraudulent elections. Huh. Well, wonder that must be Germany, right? I can't imagine he's thinking about anywhere else, can you? right. Let's see. Here's Dennis. Dennis is in Detroit. Dennis, thanks for joining me on Night Call. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi.
Hope you're doing okay.
I'm doing okay.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about our buddy, Al Sharpton.
Why do you say our buddy?
Oh, everybody's buddy.
Why do you say?
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
He was over here in Hicksville, USA on Grand Boulevard talking about rap music.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was just here a couple, 3 days ago.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, and he's blaming white corporations for degradation of black women.
That's not unusual in the black community. Sharpton may be just an exponent of it. I mean, the idea is, although there are a number of black rap indie labels, a lot of it, they say, is, here's this misogynist and violent music that is put out by the big record corporations, which they are. I mean, it used to be, for instance, way back in the day, in the 30s and 40s, 20s, 30s and 40s, that they called all black music race music. And the people playing it didn't get a lot of money, and the white owners did. Now, I guess the rappers certainly get a lot of money as well. So what's your thought on it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why he doesn't blame the black rappers and the people that buy that stuff.
Well, yeah, I hear you. I agree. I don't know. I mean, Sharpton, in a way, if you think about it, he's one of these people in America. Although he certainly takes on serious political issues and sometimes is fairly eloquent, but he's famous for being famous. Well, I mean, what the hell did he ever do? You know what I mean? I mean, he's a favorite. He's a favorite of the media. The only reason that you and I ever even, he's our buddy, is because the media has elevated him to this position. So, I don't know. In a lot of ways, you're right. I mean, there's a whole problem with music, and let me put it another way. There's a problem with censorship. I mean, being in the business, having been censored any number of times for political views, I'm pretty sensitive to people saying we shouldn't or couldn't do this. I mean, certainly if you had black owners, that wouldn't make it any better. I mean, it seems to me that the race of the owners seems to be irrelevant. And I agree. Why are people singing these lyrics? Why do particularly black men want it? And some, and white kids, why do white kids want to hear it? Why do black men want it? Or why do white and black kids or white and black men want to hear this stuff that denigrates? They say, oh, it's denigrating some bitch. Well, it also denigrates the, quote, bitch that's their mother or sister or girlfriend or what have you. And if misogynist acts are acceptable because of how they're defined through culture, well, the women that they love are as much at risk as they think the other is, So, yeah. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Yeah, I think the music sucks, to tell you the truth. But what are you going to do when people want to buy it? There's, like, for instance, there's a market for, we mentioned the Nazis, there's a market for Nazi literature. And in countries like Canada, you can't sell it. It's illegal. You can't sell Nazi literature in Germany. we can't make that kind of, and you can say, look, this isn't an opinion. That's a movement with a historical precedent in which people were terribly harmed. So that's why, but we're too afraid here, and understandably so. All right, here's what's happening, though. So those of you who are worried about the draft, that this guy sort of lost this in here. The Bush War Advisor says the draft worth a look. So here's what they're doing. So you don't have to get drafted. Somebody else will do it. If you need a down payment for your home or want seed money to start a business, the Army wants to help, if you're willing to sign up. Despite spending nearly $1 billion last year on recruiting bonuses and ads, wow, that's why they want so much money, $500 billion a year. Army leaders say an even bolder approach is needed to fulfill wartime ranks. Under a new proposal, men and women could pick from a buffet of incentives, including up to $45,000 tax-free that accrued during their career. And so an Associated Press review of the increasingly aggressive recruiting offers found the Army is not only dangling more sign-up rewards, it's loosening its rules on age and weight limits, education, and drug and criminal records. It's all part of the Army effort to fill its ranks, even as the percentage of young people who say they plan to join the military has hit an historic low, 16% by the Pentagon's own survey. They did make their July. They didn't make the recruitment target for May and June, but July, I guess they made it, giving out that kind of money. Now, here's what's happened. There's higher obesity rates, more people diagnosed with mental health conditions such as ADD, more criminal citations. And so Michael Domenez, principal deputy of Undersecretary of Defense, says the numbers of people who meet our enlistment standards is astonishingly low. So here is the solution. Lower the standards, right? Well, here's the whole package. Increasing to 20,000, the bonus for troops who join by September 30th and leave for boot camp within a month. So that could be you. Raising the enlistment age to 42. And I was asking earlier, what modern country did that during wartime? That's scary. There is and it's been raised so that there's a mother and daughter in the same unit. She's 42. The daughter's 21. Allowing recruits to come in with non-offensive tattoos on their hands and necks. So you can still have all that stuff all over you, even though you made a little bit of a mistake getting all tatted up. As long as you don't have swastikas or skulls, I guess. Who knows? Maybe they would consider skulls non-offensive. Offering 2,000 bonus to Army soldiers who refer a new recruit. Enlisting recruits who don't meet weight standards and must trim down their first year. So that'd be kind of cool, you know, if you were heavy, you could just go in there, not trim down, get the money, get out, right? Don't say I said that. Advertising that targets potential recruits' parents. Hey, send your kid off to the Iraq War and he'll get 20 grand. I added the last part. Increasing the number of recruits with general education GED diplomas rather than regular high school diplomas. That's okay. I mean, I didn't finish high school until I was 20, never finished college. Couldn't cut it. Creating a more pleasant boot camp. Excuse me, soldier. Please stand at attention instead of those guys roaring in your face. Okay? Come on. You're going to help us all. We're all friends here at boot camp. That's nice. Sending gung-ho soldiers fresh from boot camp or war zones back to their hometowns to visit old friends and schoolmates to promote the Army. Increasing to more than 15% the number of Army and Reserve troops given waivers for medical and moral reasons, or for positive drug and alcohol screen tests. This is absolutely amazing. I just can't even believe this is happening. Where is that? There is, did I lose this? Here. So they're going to lower the standards for, if you can flunk the drug test, but you can still get it. You've been doing a little smack, but what the hell? You know, we need people in the Army. But here from Salon.com, I'm not going to read you the story. It's easy for soldiers to score heroin in Afghanistan, right? Okay. It's quite a mess that these people in Washington have created, haven't they? These are awful people. They stole two elections in a row. I mean, that's why the majority of American people did not want them in office. Now, we know for sure Bush was the loser in the first election. He won, he cheated the Electoral College through his dad's buddies on the Supreme Court. But he lost the popular election, and they stole the election in Ohio in 2004. But as much as the crap that poured out of the media and out of the government and the fear and the lies and all that, still, it was twice that the American people knew better than to let these evil morons at the reins of government. And what we're doing is reaping the results of that now. And to let these guys go on for another 16 months, they have to be driven from office. I'm telling you, these might be the good old days for sure. All right, here is Watts. Watts is in Detroit. How you doing, Watts? Thanks for joining me. Peter Werby here with you.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Quick comment and question, and then a mild bitch to you. The fire in Calumet, Michigan was immortalized by the great Woody Guthrie.
Sure. It's
called 1913 Massacre, in case anybody's interested. And offhand, do you know, was he ever in Michigan?
Woody Guthrie?
Yeah, I couldn't find that information. I was just wondering by any chance. Okay. I wish you'd spend more time about the insane trade policies that we have here. Like, for instance, the tariffs are like double to like 30% higher for the difference between the countries, the U.S. and China, Japan, what have you.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's really unfair, and, you know, so many displaced workers here. You know, one-sixth of manufacturing is gone. And I wish that you would spend more time or talk up about the tax burden on the people who aren't displaced, how that affects all of us, because those people who eventually do get jobs, probably in the service industry, they're making less, so they're paying less. So everybody else is getting less bang for their buck on the taxes for the police, roads, you name it. And then also, too, for...
Wait a minute. You've done an admirable job of doing what you asked me to do.
Yeah, and also, too, the national security thing. I mean, what happens if China cops a real big attitude and,
Calls in the chits, right.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So,
there's actually an excellent book out by, and I'm trying to remember the author's name. I think it's Steve Letho, Here it is. It was opening very slowly. It's not. And I feel terrible. Steve, if you are, I've got too much going. But if it was called the Italian Hall Disaster or the 1913 Massacre, mm-hmm. and to the 73 men, women, and children who died on Christmas Eve. That's when that occurred. But I think, and I'm having some trouble finding it here online, but I interviewed the man about the author about it all.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I remember that. That was great.
Yeah, it was
very interesting.
It was great, and yeah, and it was a Woody Guthrie song. And if people are saying Woody Guthrie, who is that? Just do a Google, listen to some music, and see what that's all about.
That's Arlo's pa.
Yeah, it's Arlo Guthrie's. Yeah, yeah.
And I also too is Pete Seeger's grandson opened up for Arlo a couple years ago, and he's in a real good band called the Mammals.
Really?
Yeah, and then very good. Very good music. Oh, and also, too, whenever you mentioned China, I think it would really help if you emphasize that it's a brutal dictatorship, communist China, to really make people think, you know, how crazy, you know, the trade policies are. And with Saudi Arabia and the crazy, which you were talking earlier about the deficit as far as the U.S. borrowing from, you know, brutal dictatorship, communist China. It's ridiculous.
I got you. All right. Thanks, Watts. We'll be right back after the...
This is WRIM.com.
Now I see the truth, I guess it's down. your decisions tonight. No! Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong, take on anyone. I know that you are wrong. Headstrong, we're headstrong. Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong, take on anyone. I know that you are wrong. And this is not where you belong.
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Jalene Jordan will be back next week. I want to remind you again, 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Monique Hardin, who is a New Orleans a lawyer, advocate for environmental human rights, really still a mess down there, Bush's second big disaster. And then Henry Picciotto as well, chair of Jewish Voice for Peace. Let me see here. Oh, yeah, Paul wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com because we were talking about the economy. And he said, you mentioned vacations at the beginning of your show. I just wanted to share a quick story with you. I was saying that, like everything else, why aren't we number one? That more we have the lowest amount of days off, the fewest amount of days off of any industrialized country. He says, I was up north this weekend and to my surprise found a Michigan State Forest campground closed up by Fairview. Due to a lack of state funding. I talked to a DNR, Department of Natural Resource officer, who was standing by the lake keeping an eye on the boaters. He said they were short $57,000 and had to close five campgrounds. I'm just wondering, how much do we pay to drop a bomb in Iraq? That's where it's all going. You know, you're talking about What have they spent so far? About half a trillion. It's going to be maybe $2.1 trillion when it's all done, rather than having our state be a jewel, rather than having free universities so people don't have to be bribed into going into the military. So he says, even when we get, pardon me, to take vacations, the state doesn't think it's worth it to keep the recreation areas open. It's a sad affair. Oh, well, I didn't see that part. Well, the problem is the money ain't there. Money just isn't there. All right, let's see. Let's go to Deshaun in Detroit. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I was calling about most of the stuff that you were saying. I wonder why you don't speak up on more about people claiming their sovereignty rights, or even talk about the Bill of Rights. I mean, well, people are worried about being drafted, and because the United States is a corporation, they people should be able to prepare themselves to deal with certain things like that and say, look, I have the rights under the Bill of Rights not to be drafted.
How do you figure that's in there?
Well, have you ever read Hale versus Haskell?
No. Tell me about that.
Well, Hale versus Haskell make it clear that you have a sovereign right, long as it doesn't interfere with any, long as you do not harm anybody else. Just like look at the UCC codes, 1-308. Because the United States is a corporation, they have certain rules that they have to apply by.
How do you figure the United States is a corporation?
Well, because basically it is. It does that. When you remember how they used to say under the Republic, it doesn't say under the Republic. And when people sit there and they say, okay, the government can do this and that, one of the main things I don't hear is people saying, what does the Bill of Rights say? The Bill of Rights make it clear that your rights are inalienable.
Well, in which one? I mean, I've got it sitting right in front of me. I mean, you might hear, here's what I think. And people have, when it came to the draft, people have said that, what is it, the 14th, that abolishes involuntary servitude except as punishment. But that's been tried before, Deshaun. And the courts, of course, are very political. I mean, you can put Japanese in concentration camps and the Supreme Court upholds it, right? I mean, at one point, the different points. They upheld slavery. They upheld segregation. They upheld the income tax, which some people say is not permissible under the Constitution. But the courts obviously do anything that's politically what's needed politically. So I wonder how. I mean, how can you be in a country and when they had a draft and say, okay, you got to go fight in Vietnam, and you say, well, I don't agree with that war, and they say, too bad. You got to go kill and take a chance of being killed. What's up with that?
But the difference is with that, people do that because they think they're supposed to do it. And when I give you an example, like somebody was just talking about the taxes.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Look up there a case called USA versus, and I got to spell her name out. It's spelled K-U-G-L-I-N.
Okay.
And then it's another case that just recently came out. This guy's name is Cryer, and it was made clear. They asked the government, where do you have the authority to force me to pay taxes? They lost those cases, both of them. Those cases are now set precedent because the basic fact is they said, where in the law do you can force me to pay taxes? And the prosecution said there's no law. They did fail to provide. Like in the case, the first case I told you, the woman won the case, and the prosecutor said, well, judge, at least force her to pay the taxes. You know what he said? I'm not the IRS. Like I said with the case with Hale versus Haskell, look that case up and read it, and you will see what it said.
Well, Deshaun, there was a federal statute that instituted the federal income tax, and it's spotty. I mean, there's whole groups of people that are claiming that the Constitution forbids a tax on income. That other things are okay, and trade and what have you. But and it's sort of a spotty record. I don't understand. I mean, some of these people that have been selling this as advice and guaranteeing people that they won't get prosecuted have wound up getting prosecuted. But I will check it out. All right, thanks a lot. All righty. I mean, I don't object to paying taxes per se. I object to where my tax money is going. And by the way, There is no need for any tax increase in Michigan. There's no need for any tax increase in the United States, except on the wealthy. The middle class and the working class should have, and some of the working class are middle class by virtue of income, but should be having tax reductions. The ultra wealthy and the corporations ought to have more and more taxes piled upon them to pay for what they benefit from. All right. That said, let me move on. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, here is Lauren. Lauren's in Macomb. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
Okay. This kind of ties in with everything everybody's been saying with the guy that said the money on, you know, the campground got shut down, and the gentleman about an hour or so ago with having to pay for Medicare now and all this money for recruiting. I'm 19. I've had some health problems, and I just had a daughter back in January. I was diagnosed with postpartum depression, and because of being pregnant and not being able to not find a job, I didn't have a job for about 7-8 months. And I went to FIA down here in Macomb and got a little bit of help. I was getting about $350 a month in cash assistance. So I went to the Work First program through Michigan to try to help me get a job, and they decided that I should get help with my medical problems and my postpartum and all that junk, and it got sent back to my FIA worker. She decided I should be on disability against my will. I've told her over and over again I don't want to be. So now I'm working. I'm not making as much money as I was when I was getting cash assistance, and they want to cut me off, and I don't have any money to throw my daughter in daycare, which they are supposed to help me with, and they aren't. And so if I wasn't getting this help and I kept my job, if I put my daughter in daycare, I would actually be in debt to the daycare. I might as well not even work.
Yeah.
So now I'm getting cut off from my assistance, and I'm being told that I'm probably going to have to start paying for most of my medical bills for my daughter and I. And I was talking to one of the head gentlemen up at the Work First program who was actually quite frank and honest with me about a lot of things and telling me, you know, all this money is being cut because of the war. And the thing I find funny, you know, this war over terrorism, oil, whatever, I just find it funny that all this money is going all over the place, like I said, to the recruiting. Especially, I mean, I don't remember exactly what the figures you said were about all this money for recruiting and then the $57,000 cut and all the campgrounds that had to be shut down. And now, like the gentleman earlier that was on SSI, and now they want to make him pay for his Medicare. And I agree that these taxes shouldn't go up. And I have family and family friends and my friends that were glad that I was getting assistance because they felt like their taxes were being worth something.
Now, you know, they could just cut the war budget, which was just passed, of $500 billion just for next year. This is just next year. And that would leave us with about $250 billion, which would still be larger than any country in the world and probably almost total what all the country, at least the major countries, spend. And that $250 billion would be enough to solve your problems. You know, in a way that would leave you with dignity and send you on the right road to what you want to accomplish in your life, to have good health without having to you know, be humiliated the way so many people in your situation often are. And yet there is this, on one hand, of course, the political system is set up to send it all to where it's currently going. But then you also have this extraordinary cruel streak among a lot of Americans. It's not a very admirable trait at all. And that is that people are thinking, like, too bad. Why didn't she work harder? Or, why, you know, she got herself into it or something like that. Well, best of luck to you. I hope things turn in a good direction. And I hope as a country we can see where this has all brought us, both these attitudes and these political and economic policies, and do something about it. All right. Thank you very much. Here, Pete in Tecumseh has sent, I haven't looked out, all the shades are pulled here, but he's a great show tonight. Actually, he doesn't say this, but there's a better one outside. He says, I'm getting ready to go outside and watch the sky. Tonight is the peak of the Perseid, is that how you say it? P-E-R-S-E-I-D, meteor shower. You can see up to 75 meteors per hour If you are somewhere dark, look up. It will be the best couple of hours before sunrise, but there should be plenty of meteors to see all night. When I came in, it was clouded over. The radiant, which is where the majority of the meteors appear to start, is in the constellation of Perseus, which is in the northeast sky. Okay. It will slowly move west through the night and be almost overhead during those couple of hours before morning. Right. Finding someplace dark, that is certainly the challenge around here, to be sure. All right, let's grab... I'm glad we're going to get this call in a minute or so. Here's Todd in Port Huron. Todd, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I was just driving home, and I caught you talking about Blackwater.
Yeah.
Private company that's over in Iraq, assisting the military. But there's one thing I don't think a lot of people realize, that Blackwater and another company called Dyncorp are recruiting officers from all over the country with tactical training. That's ESU, ERT, SRT, and SWAT. So they're basically trying to recruit these officers to assist and train Iraqi police officers in those countries. Well, when you go down and train, like I was down there for a while in Virginia, you go through the basics, the language and the customs, for about a week, and then you ship you down to Fort, I think it's Fort Dix or Fort Pix in Texas.
Now, this is the Army or this is Blackwater?
What's that?
Is this the Army or the Black or Blackwater?
Oh, this is Blackwater and Dyncorp.
Right. I'm familiar with them. Which were you training with?
I was in Dyncorp.
Okay. All right.
And when you get down there, they don't tell you, oh, by the way, you are going to be assisting the military and convoy training only.
Ah.
So but the money they pay you is it makes the military soldiers, as you can imagine, a little upset. You know, we're making about $250,000 a year with a $50,000 signing bonus if you stay under 6 months. But they're not there to assist the military. They're there just to protect the convoys, and the injury ratio is just, it's amazing how it never makes the news.
Yeah, well, also, there's just something in the paper today in the Washington Post. Says the U.S. military has paid $500 million over the past 3 years to two British security firms that protect the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It's not even, you know, so this is $500 million going out to British citizens on reconstruction projects, more than $200 million over the original budget, according to previously undisclosed data that shows how the cost of private security in Iraq has mushroomed. So this is $500 million there of our tax money being paid to Brits. That's wonderful, huh?
Well, I can believe that.
All right. I'm going to have to cut this a little short because we're almost at the end of the show, but thank you for your experience. I wish we could talk a little more on it. Let's go to Ray in Windsor. Ray, thanks for making our show international. I appreciate you waiting. Ray, are you with us?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. No, I caught the tail end of your show a few weeks back, and you were talking about how somehow the colored troops, their votes from overseas were going to be filtered through and more than likely not counted. And I was...
Colored troops?
Well, yeah.
You mean like African-American? Is that
African-American, yeah.
Okay, that's okay. That's an old-fashioned phrase, but that's okay. It's not derogatory. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. And I was just curious because I do have a colored friend, an American colored friend overseas, and I'm just worried that if there is any truth to this, that I can converse with them and let them know what the deal is.
This sounds familiar. I don't remember talking about it too much. There was a whole, maybe it was African-American troops who were, because there was a lot of GI votes that weren't counted. Right now, I don't really know enough about it to say, but I will check it out. If you want to email me, I'll try to email you back. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, thanks a lot. Here's Keith in Madison Heights. Keith, you have about 60 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, I'll say it real quick. What do you think about Senator Ron Paul? He wants to get rid of the IRS, and I think that's just the greatest idea in the world.
Well, it doesn't seem to work real well, does it? I mean, well, if you took in my system, which would have a $50,000 tax deduction right off the bat, you sure would have a lot less people paying income tax to begin with. Let's just have all those people that are making excess wealth pay the freight. They're the ones that are benefiting the most. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. Jalene Jordan will be with me back next week. She'll tell us about her time at the Michigan Women's Music Festival. Stay tuned for a couple of interesting interviews, and we'll talk next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Don't feel the reaper.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. An anniversary coming up, a very dreadful one. In fact, the second anniversary of the Katrina disaster. And it was a political, an ecological, a financial, and most of all, it was a human catastrophe. So many people are still suffering. Mostly, it is out of our consciousness. We don't hear too much about it. Once in a while, a little bit of the ongoing scandal that we hear with the trailers and all of this. But there, it is so multidimensional of what is still going on in the Gulf Coast, I thought it was appropriate that we'd bring someone to our microphones that's right on top of it all. And our guest is Monique Hardin. She's co-director and attorney at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. And she just gave me a lesson. I was saying New Orleans, but she is in New Orleans, right, Monique Hardin?
That's correct. That's the city.
Okay. And you were born and raised in the city?
Well, I wasn't born in New Orleans, but my family moved back to New Orleans, when I was 8 years old, and have been living here ever since. So for a little bit more than 30 years, this has been my home. And I'd like to say that it will continue to be my home, notwithstanding the problems we're continuing to have with the privatization of our neighborhoods, public hospitals and schools and the like, and the real devastating effect it's having, not just on our physical environment, but also on the mental health of people who are struggling to come back home and to to rebuild their communities.
Were you in the city when Katrina hit?
No, my family and I, we had evacuated Sunday before the hurricane came onshore, and it was, we spent the next 2 weeks trying to locate other family members and neighbors and friends using cell phones and emailing as best we can. It was just, a horrendous experience to not know if the people you know and love are still with you.
Yeah, the pattern was, it sounds like what happened is that the fortunate people were the ones that had middle-class means, and the people that really suffered were the poor who were unable to get out.
No, you're absolutely right, Peter. The way the evacuation plan was set up was that if you didn't have your own vehicle or way of sharing a vehicle and resources to find accommodations or lodging outside of the city, there was nothing for you. And as you saw, and as a world witness, mostly African-American residents of the city of New Orleans were trapped in a flooded city.
Monique Hardin is my guest, and she's the co-director of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. I think maybe we ought to clarify what environmental human rights are. Most of us know, hopefully, what human rights, when we speak of it in normal discourse. What are environmental human rights?
Well, environmental human rights focus on the right to a healthy environment. As people in Detroit know that it's mostly African-American neighborhoods that where there are tremendous inequities in environmental protection and ensuring that there's clean air and clean water and that the built environment is planned in a way that it functions and serves the communities so that, inequities in transportation are also problems of examples of environmental injustice that mostly African-American people are subjected to. What we do at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights is provide legal services and public advocacy support to communities that are in the struggle for environmental justice, particularly through the way of reforming the way in which our government currently has set up this environmental regulatory system that actually allows communities, whether it's in Detroit, Michigan, or communities here in New Orleans or around the United States, to live in very toxic, unhealthy environments.
Sure, I know when they cited about 20 years ago this enormous open burn incinerator, they put it right in the middle of one of the poorest African American neighborhoods, and there was, in fact, I'm looking right now on screen at your website, which is ehumanrights.org, and it says Stop Environmental Racism. So is there a difference between environmental human rights and environmental racism?
Well, no, environmental racism is the problem. And environmental human rights is a solution, because when you talk about the open burn incinerator being located in a African-American neighborhood, what you're really saying is that for the people who live in that neighborhood, their right to life, their right to health, their right to racial equality, their right to security of their homes are all being violated by the governmental decisions that allow this kind of operation to take place in, you know, next to their homes, next to their schools, you know, in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so environmental human rights is, it brings a whole new perspective to what it means to protect the environment so that we're ensuring that fundamental human rights are protected and are not subjected to being undermined or abused or violated by an assortment of environmental decision-making, which has been the case, you know, for decades now.
All right, this has been an excellent general picture of what your organization, Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, does. Give us like a concrete example of something in New Orleans that that your organization has been taking on and helping with that fits the general description.
Well, we have two key projects at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. The one deals with the need for reforming the environmental regulatory system so that it does protect human rights. And in Louisiana, we're working with a community in the community of Mossville, which is just outside of New Orleans in the southwest portion of the state. And it's in this African-American community that was founded in the 1790s where the U.S. government has allowed 14 toxic industrial facilities to operate. And, you know, the waters that people fish from are contaminated. The fish is poisoned by the industrial emissions and discharges. The air is unhealthy to breathe. And the bodies of Mossville residents, you know, very serious toxic chemicals are wreaking havoc on their health. Notwithstanding this bleak picture in terms of the environmental conditions in the Mossville community, we've got, you know, our government has legalized those facilities that surround them and spew all of this, you know, toxic pollution on the community every day.
Is this benzene? Is this where all these...
Oh, benzene is just the tip of the iceberg.
Really?
I mean, we're talking about benzene, mercury, sulfur compounds, dioxins, ethylene dichloride, vinyl chloride monomer, just a toxic soup that's created by 14 industrial facilities that to this day continue to get permits to release more pollution in the community. And when the community goes to the government and says, this is wrong and this is how we're suffering from it, the government says, well, it's legal under our system. There's nothing we can do about it.
So do you lobby or do you bring lawsuits or both?
We do both. We actually have litigation against the U.S. government on behalf of the residents of Mossville, Louisiana. And this litigation has been filed with an international human rights adjudicative body called the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which investigates complaints of human rights abuses occurring in the United States and 33 other countries that are members of the Organization of American States.
Hmm.
And so we filed this petition in March 2005 on behalf of the residents of Mossville. Right now, the legal petition is pending with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and they've submitted to the U.S. State Department notification for a response. And we're waiting for that response from the U.S. State Department which we believe there's no way you can or anyone can defend the harm that's been brought to this community.
It sounds just awful, to be sure. And we find that so frequently in industrial sites around our country. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Monique Hardin. She's co-director and attorney at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. We're reaching her in New Orleans, and we're talking about the situation there and some of the surrounding districts that her organization is assisting. Now, I'm sitting here surrounded by all sorts of things that have been congealed out of chemicals, so and it's a product of our industrial chemical nuclear society, and so it does it wind up to be the NIMBY factor, the not in my backyard, is that we go, whew, I'm sure glad that incinerator isn't up in my neighborhood that's in Detroit, or whew, I'm sure glad that that benzene plant is in Mossville and not in, you know, in my, I mean, in other words, this stuff has to be somewhere if we're going to continue with this industrialized chemical system.
Well, I think that's a false choice that's presented by people who profit from the pollution. And the reality is, and what they'd often, you know, purveyors of that kind of perspective. What they don't talk about is that there are innovative ways in which products can be made and manufactured so that waste and toxic pollution are eliminated and or minimized. There are innovative things going on in terms of manufacturing called green chemistry, which looks at products at the molecular level with the idea of how can you make something that's sticky or shiny or glossy without using toxic chemicals or toxic molecules to create the product. Right now, that's not at all required by our environmental regulatory system. And so what we have are the same manufacturing that took place when, you know, 50 years ago is still virtually the same manufacturing we have today. So we have a very obsolete and very toxic and very costly way of manufacturing products when there's so much new technology and innovation that's been brought to us. I mean, hell, we're in the 21st century now that is not required of manufacturing today. And so the people who pay the cost are often African-American people and other people of color. And that shows, you know, the injustice of not requiring the best and the kinds of manufacturing, the best kind of environmental stewardship for the people in this country.
You know, I'm trying to think as we speak. It's barely a governing body, but it's the Joint International Commission or something for the Great Lakes, because where we live, it's, you know, boundary waters here between us and Canada. And they have a policy of zero emission into the Great Lakes, which they have no enforcement power. So things like the Detroit incinerator continues to spew out some of the same things you mentioned from Mossville or not. Yeah, Louisiana, though I don't think quite to the extent. And yet, and as we said earlier, it's cited in a poor African-American community, but what comes out of those smokestacks doesn't stay there. It goes across a very wealthy area, Grosse Pointe, Michigan. It goes across the Detroit River into middle-class communities in Windsor, Ontario. So you can see, you know, how poor people, I mean, through class discrimination and race discrimination, who people in that category get the worst end of the stick historically, but in a sense, this affects everyone. This affects the middle-class person, the wealthy person. I mean, we all share the same planet, and maybe at ground zero, it's the poor folks that are getting it worse. But why you would think even these rich guys would think, wait a minute, man, I don't want to smell this stuff, and I don't want to get this stuff in my lungs. What's their motivation? Is it just financial?
I think it's purely financial. When laws are created around environment, especially at the federal level, and regulations to implement those laws are created at the federal agency level, regular folks, you know, citizens, community groups, whatever, they're not at the table shaping what those laws and regulations should look like, what it should provide, what it should deliver, what it should protect. Instead, you've got industrial companies and their various trade associations there at the table shaping and negotiating what those laws and regulations ought to look like. And so as a result, we get what we have, which is really a broken environmental protection system. And one thing I want to add here is that the United States government actually lags behind hundreds of other countries around the world that have constitutions and other national laws that recognize the human right to a healthy environment, to a sustained ecological conditions that are preserved and protected. The United States government, there's nothing in our Constitution that recognizes that. Attempts made through lawsuits to get the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution as providing such a right have been knocked down in years past. And we've got national laws that actually cater to the industrial interests, interests of industrial polluters. Not only in that way does our country lag behind that of other countries around the world, but also when it comes to protecting people in the event of disasters. Case in point, Hurricane Katrina and the hundreds of thousands of people who remain displaced from their communities, from not just New Orleans but the Gulf region, do not have the protection that other countries have in terms of being able to have the support and the assistance to come back home and rebuild.
Mm-hmm. I get distracted on important points so easily, and we were certainly off into industrial production and the effects of it, that yes, I'm glad you brought us back to Katrina. We're at the second anniversary almost, and my guest, Monique Hardin, works with Advocates for Environmental Human Rights in New Orleans, and at the beginning of this interview, you quickly went over the word privatization, and fill that in terms of what that means in this context.
Well, at a time when, you know, the people from New Orleans and the Gulf region were trying to find shelter, trying to find each other, trying to locate friends and family members, the Bush administration set out to privatize the region through a number of strategies that involved suspending federal laws that protect prevailing wage standards for workers, federal law known as the Davis-Bacon Act, through creating huge incentives through tax breaks and other economic lures for private developers to come in and basically, you know, conduct land grabs of in communities affected by the storm, through waiving and repealing environmental laws and standards, privatizing schools and public health care facilities. So the result of that strategy is that the public health care facilities that were up and operating before Katrina had still not been built, and we're now coming up on the second year. Many of our public schools have been turned into charter schools, which can, if the board of those schools or however they're structured in terms of governance, can exercise selective criteria that would exclude students seeking education of any sort, for that matter. One of the results is that we had at the beginning of the spring semester in January 2007 of this year, over 300 students who were denied enrollment because there wasn't enough funding for opening up the schools or staffing those schools. And we've got a situation where public housing residents, about 5,000 families, are locked out, I mean physically locked out of their homes that sustain no damage. Those homes are now under contract for private development. One of the developers is seeking to build a golf course there.
You know, there's been the charge that the Republic, this is another Karl Rove strategy, and this would turn New Orleans from a primarily African-American city that was Democratic into a primarily Euro-American city that would be a Republican. Do you buy that at all?
Well, that would be certainly an outcome. That would be certainly an outcome, because if anyone who's paying attention can see that the greatest impacts on the failure of recovery and this real push around privatization, that the losers are African Americans. In addition to what I just laid out, one key piece to this is that, you know, we now know that the levees and flood walls built by the Army Corps of Engineers were substandard.
Right.
And what's happened since Katrina is the Corps has been going about this process of repairing and upgrading levees and flood walls. And June of this year, the Army Corps of Engineers reported that no African American neighborhood that flooded during Katrina would have any substantial flood reduction.
Oh.
Whereas white neighborhoods that flooded during Katrina will have 5.5 feet of flood waters reduced.
Is this what they need? I mean, we trying to think of the other area that I just saw, but you know how? I know it's actually somewhere in Asia, but in London and in the Netherlands, they have this sophisticated huge walls that come up in the times of flood surge and what have you. Is there enough being spent to protect New Orleans from another such catastrophe?
No, there's not enough being spent on the kind of flood protection system, quite sophisticated flood protection system that you have in Holland, notwithstanding taxpayers sending members of the U.S. Senate and the governor of Louisiana to visits in Holland and meeting with the engineers of their flood protection system. Nothing has come out of that in terms of building something on par with that for the Gulf region.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of reconstruction, I know that there are a number of self-generated projects. When the government failed to act, miserably failed to act, people themselves took over. Things like the Common Ground Project and Food Not Bombs went in to feed people. There were volunteer medical collectives that went there. Habitat for Humanity is building houses. Certainly the government should have had flood protection, that this never occurred, and when it occurred, they should have been there in an instant. But there is something heartening about the way that people have taken things into their own hands. So it's sort of a paradox in my mind. On one hand, the government completely fails, and they shouldn't have. Yet on the other hand, the neighborhoods and groups and collectives have done such extraordinary work. Is there a way really to integrate those two processes?
Well, sure. I mean, we have, for anything that's good that you can point to, and I'm going to be really specific about the city of New Orleans, it's been because of the people who lived in that community rolling up their sleeves and taking care of it, and the support of volunteers from around the country, helping them and aiding them in that process. So we have a few health clinics that have been started by grassroots members of the community with professional degrees in nursing and medicine. Just starting it, just establishing their own clinic. It may have been a house before, but now it's the clinic in the neighborhood. And we have the same thing for a school that just opened in the Ninth Ward, and called the Martin Luther King School. Again, the community doing that work. The problem that we have from government is not accurately phrased as a bureaucratic bungling or a slowness or failure, but it's really hostile to the needs of people who are struggling to return and rebuild their communities in New Orleans and the Gulf region. And that hostility is fueled by this privatization scheme.
Well,
that our government is sponsoring. When you look around the world, you see that disasters are not uncommon, whether it's earthquake or man-made conflicts, and that the result is that populations are forced to leave their communities, but they stay within their countries. And the treatment of those displaced people has been part of on the international radar, in particular the United Nations, in establishing actually a set of human rights-based standards for ensuring their right to return home or voluntarily resettle elsewhere. This is something that our U.S. government has been a supporter of and has encouraged other countries to do, but in this situation, we see the U.S. government actually working in a way that's contrary and hostile to those human rights standards for people who are displaced by disaster and are struggling to return home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to the extent that you have, I don't know how many, at least over 100,000, is it more?
At least 200,000 from the Gulf region.
Wow. So a few are here in Detroit. I know I've heard them speak on local media, but a lot of them in Houston, where didn't Barbara Bush said they had a wonderful opportunity?
I think she really exposed something about the Bush family in those comments that she made, and the reaction to her words, I think really helped to fuel more support for getting people back home, because I think what she said really exposed that there is no, there's not one. That one finger will be lifted by this Bush administration to protect the human rights of folks who are displaced and enabling them to be able to come back home.
Monique Harden, remind us, at least in general or specifically, what Barbara Bush, George's mother, said. I can't formulate it exactly.
I can't remember the exact but the summary was that people, gathered in this makeshift shelter in Houston, her comments were like, this is probably the best kind of living condition that they've ever had, and they should be thankful for it.
Yeah, and then she went up to Kennebunkport. Well, we're out of time, but Monique Harden, I don't like to leave people in a situation of solely concern or compassion. Are there things that people can do, like up here? I know your website is in development. It still has some good information on it, ehumanrights.org. Should we just keep alert, or are there actual things Well, yes, there
are specific things that folks can do. It would be really getting in touch with their members of Congress, because notwithstanding the great work that's been done at the grassroots level by communities and by, you know, a strong outpouring of volunteers from around the country, ultimately all of that, the effect of that is a drop in the bucket, because this is a tremendous amount of devastation that still persists to this day, and it requires federal recovery and federal resources and federal commitment. And so if the people of Detroit can pick up the phone and call members of Congress to say, we need support for the people of New Orleans and the Gulf region and rebuilding, and that needs to happen now, it would go a long way.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me. My guest has been Monique Hardin. She's co-director and attorney at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. Again, the website, ehumanrights.org. And I'll have a link on my site as well at peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Monique Hardin, thanks for joining me on the program.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4. With a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica. With a big unit. Every weekday night at 10. Exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIM. Everything that rocks. This is WRIM.com.
www.RIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, there's many, seemingly at least, intractable political and military disputes around the world. And if you're not directly involved in them, very frequently you can see, well, you can say, well, these people have been fighting forever, like the people in the Balkans or Northern Ireland, and perhaps most prominently in the Middle East, where we see in Iraq Shiites and Sunnis fighting one another based on their different religious conceptions. And in Israel, the disputes between the Israelis and the Palestinians, again, many people will just say, well, they've been fighting each other forever. Fortunately, there's a voice for peace, and there's many of them, as we'll find out. One is called Jewish Voice for Peace, and joining me is Henry Pacioto, and Henry Pacioto is joining us from Oakland, California. Henry, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
And you are you the director of the organization, are you?
I'm the chair of the board.
The chair of the board. All right. And tell us, actually, you have an interesting personal history. Tell us a little about yourself and tell us some about the Jewish Voice for Peace.
Okay. I grew up in Lebanon, Jewish, and experienced a country with what then was a peaceful coexistence between different religious groups, kind of different from this idea that people have always been at each other's throat. But, you know, how my family got there actually is related to all the conflicts. My parents were from Syria, and even though our family had been in Syria for, you know, really a couple of hundred years with no problem, when the State of Israel was created, that inflamed some tensions, and synagogues were burning, and Jews from Syria, not all of them, but most of them dispersed, and my parents chose to go to Lebanon, and I was born soon after that. So I grew up not having directly experienced, any of these conflicts, but by the time I was a teenager, the 67 war happened, and after, you know, my first 17 years with no issues between myself or any Jews and non-Jews in Lebanon, after the 67 conflict, I heard my first anti-Semitic comment, and ended up, I was leaving the country anyway to go to school, but I ended up never going back, and most Jews left Lebanon. So,
and this is not an unusual pattern. I mean, when you said, there was this out-migration from Syria at the time of Israel. And so tell me a little about the languages that your parents and you, your parents speak, or you speak. Does that mean you know Hebrew and Yiddish and Arabic?
My parents spoke mostly Arabic to each other, though my father could read Hebrew, for the purposes of prayer, he didn't actually understand what he was reading. My mother and her family spoke Ladino. Yiddish was essentially not spoken at all in the Middle East, until Israel, but and many Jews in the Arab countries, came to the Middle East from Spain and Portugal at the time of the Inquisition, running from the Inquisition.
In the 15th century, right.
Yeah. And brought with them the Ladino language, which is sort of to Spanish what Yiddish is to German. I mean, kind of a version of Spanish spoken in those Jewish communities. And so growing up, I heard Ladino on the part of my mother and her family quite a bit. I heard, you know, Arabic between my parents and, you know, in the street. My parents sent me to a French school and spoke French to me, figuring that it was unlikely that I would, you know, spend the rest of my life in Lebanon, and that so they kind of prepared me for leaving and sent me to a French school and spoke French to me. So anyway, so that's the language story.
Right. Well, Henry Picciotto is my guest. He's the chair of the board of Jewish Voice for Peace, and your last name is spelled P-I-C-C-I-O-T-T-O, which I would have taken for Italian, and your first name, Henry, is spelled R-I, which I would have thought was Henri. I mean, we're going to not spend, I promise you, we're not going to spend too much time on all of this, but I think it gives people an idea of the cross currents of migration that's occurred in the Middle East.
Exactly. On my father's side, which is where the name came from, on my mother's side, they went directly from Spain to Turkey, you know, in the 15th century. On my father's side, they went to Italy, where the spelling changed from a Portuguese spelling, which has an X in it, to the one you just spelled out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in Italy for, you know, a couple hundred years before moving to Syria. So that's where it all comes from. And the first name, Henri, was because they figured that translates pretty well. If he goes to America, it'll be Henry.
There you go. All right. Well, the name of your group, Jewish Voice for Peace, most Israelis, in fact, I would say almost all Israelis, say they want peace. The government of both when either Labor or the conservatives are in, everybody wants peace. Why is Jewish Voice for Peace, or how does it distinguish itself from everyone else who says that they advocate peace in that region?
Well, unfortunately, when leaders in government speak of peace is when we need to worry, because they often mean quite the opposite. What the Israelis have done since 67 in occupying the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem is they've created a situation that just cannot yield peace unless it gets resolved. I sympathize with the majority of Israelis who want to live in peace and security and who don't want to be blown up, you know, by a suicide bomber, or who don't want their kids to be killed when serving in the army. But that peace and security is not going to be possible as long as the Palestinians are treated the way they have been in this occupation. And that's a central tenet of our organization is we want to see an end to the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. That's the only road to peace. And talk of peace without addressing that is just not realistic. It's not going to happen. If people can't, you know, move. I mean, within the West Bank, for example, you can't get from one place to another without going through Israeli checkpoints. People are separated by the separation wall. It often separates people's homes from where they work or from the schools and hospitals where they need to go to. This is the sort of thing that people cannot tolerate forever, and peace is just not going to happen until the Palestinians, can live in dignity and without constant harassment by the Israeli military.
Now, the Israelis would say that all of this that you described was necessary because of the security situation. If the Palestinians would stop suicide bombings and rocket attacks and border incursions, they wouldn't need the wall of separation. They wouldn't need the checkpoints and the rest of it. So there seems to be there's an incredible circularity there, to be sure.
Of course, and vice versa. I mean, you know, that's the nature of that sort of argument. Take that separation wall. If they had built it on the Israeli border, I can't imagine that it would be less effective in terms of security, quite the opposite. You know, right now they're enclosing large chunks of the West Bank on the Israeli side of the wall. What security sense does that make? If you look at the where this wall goes in complete violation of international law, is, you know, it sort of snakes around the West Bank, putting the, you know, resources on the Israeli side, you know, especially water and good land, dividing up the Palestinian communities. If the goal was strictly security, they would just build it along the Israeli border, you know, I think that they would be within their rights.
Tell us some about the work that Jewish Voice for Peace does. Is it strictly a U.S. group?
Yeah. There are similar groups, you know, of course, within Israel and in Europe and elsewhere. But our organization is strictly within the U.S., though we work with these other groups. We have two main campaigns right now. I mean, aside from general kind of education, you know, you can find out a lot of information about the Middle East conflict on our website, jvp.org. In terms of campaigns, we have two main focuses right now. For some time, we've been working against the Caterpillar Corporation. They make weaponized bulldozers, which are used in the demolition of Palestinian homes and orchards. And they make those exclusively for the Israeli government. That's the only weapon that they make. Everything else, you know, is normal, you know, is related to construction and agriculture and so on. But these weaponized bulldozers are used in home demolitions. So homes can be demolished and are demolished by the thousands, by the Israelis, for example, for, you know, construction permit violations when construction permits are not possible to get.
These are Palestinian homes.
Palestinian homes,
yeah.
Orchards are often destroyed to make way for Israeli-only roads within the West Bank, where, you know, roads that connect the settlements that where only Israeli cars are allowed. The most famous nefarious use of this bulldozer was the killing of an American peace activist, Rachel Corey, who was standing in front of a bulldozer that was about to destroy the home of a doctor.
Now, are the Israelis still carrying out punitive demolitions? I mean, before it was to dissuade families from allowing their children to be suicide bombers. So there was someone carried out a suicide bombing or some sort of attack on Israel. In retaliation, the Israeli state would demolish their home, and of course that was gave them really bad publicity. Do they still use it as a punitive weapon?
That's a small fraction of the demolitions are exactly, you know, in what you described and in the way you described, and that is very much against international law. You're not supposed to punish, you know, the relatives of somebody who commits a crime. That is,
collective punishment, right?
Yeah, collective punishment is not supported by international law, but that's a small fraction. I mean, I think they continue to do this, but that's a small fraction of the demolition. It's a much broader phenomenon with you know, tens of thousands of homes demolished, you know, the Palestinians see it as a pressure to make, you know, to force them to leave their land, that life is being made impossible for them, and this is just the most extreme aspect of it. You know, the bulldozers show up, you have 10 minutes to get out, and then they demolish the house. It's very it's brutal and really largely has nothing to do with security.
Do you think that there really is a commitment among the Israeli elite and the politicians to have a two-state solution? I mean, of course, you're absolutely right, Henry Pacioto, that many Palestinians feel that the idea is to make life for Palestinians so miserable as it is, that they will voluntarily leave. It'll be like a voluntary transfer. And, of course, some on the right in Israeli politics want a forced transfer. That is essentially an ethnic cleansing, and that the biblical, as they see, the biblical prophecy of Jewish control of the West Bank will be satisfied. So I know the majority of the Israeli people want this settled and what have you, but is there a behind the scenes, I mean, if you know, elite schemes to much more terrible solution?
Well, I think that some of the Israeli politicians make no secret that they would, you know, they promote so-called transfer, you know, in other words, ethnic cleansing. But it's hard to interpret the continued growth of the settlements and, you know, which you know, basically the Israelis have been colonizing large chunks of the West Bank. It's hard to see this as compatible. It's impossible to see that as compatible with the two-state solution. I mean, they basically remember what happened when they withdrew the settlers from Gaza. That was about 2% of the settlers were in Gaza, and withdrawing them was presented as a grand gesture by the Israelis, and it was presented as an incredibly heroic compromise on their part. That was for about 2% of the settlers. What will happen if there were to be a two-state solution tomorrow? That's many, many, many more settlers that would have to be moved out. It seems like placing the settlements there is a huge obstacle to such a solution. The thing about a two-state solution at this point is that, almost everybody's for it, you know, from George Bush to the Israeli government to the Palestinians. I mean, nobody's opposed to a two-state solution, you know, except for, you know, very small groups. But in general, it's just words. I mean, certainly on the part of the U.S. and the Israeli government, it's just rhetoric. I mean, what happened since Oslo is that the Israelis have worked very hard to make it, you know, very difficult to pull off. I mean, it may still be possible. Who knows? But it's become harder and harder with the growth of the settlements.
Mm-hmm. Now, I interviewed a few months ago Ali Abu Nima, who you're familiar with, who is the webmaster of Electronic Intifada and has a book out calling for a one-state solution, that the idea of an exclusivist state is preferable as opposed to an exclusivist state. And yet I'm reminded of the words of the well-known American and Israeli fascist Meir Kahane, who years before his assassination said that Israel can either be democratic or Jewish, meaning that that there's a demographic against that works against the Jewish exclusivity, and that to allow everything that even the two-state people call for would essentially mean no possibility of a Jewish state. Certainly, a one-state solution eliminates that completely.
Well, our organization supports the national rights of Jews in the Middle East, in Palestine, Israel, and the national rights of Palestinians, and we would welcome any solution that recognizes both of those groups' needs and that they can reach agreement on. We are not fixated on either two states or one state. I mean, the one state solution at this point has fairly limited support. You know,
sure.
Ali Abu Nima has written a book, and there are a few other intellectuals, but majority of Israelis and Palestinians are still hoping for a two state resolution. And frankly, in my view, either a two state solution or a one state solution would be an improvement over the current situation, as long as the rights of Jews and Arabs were respected, you know, in those configurations.
My guest is Henry Pachotto. He's the chair of the board of Jewish Voice for Peace. The website is either, I guess you can either go to jewishvoiceforpeace.org or you can go to jvp.org as well?
Yes.
Okay. And you mentioned that Jewish Voice for Peace has two current projects that are prominent. One was opposing the Caterpillar Corporation's...
Yes. Let me give you a little more... we sort of got sidetracked from that. Let me just explain this a little more. So Caterpillar makes those weaponized bulldozers. We, Jewish Voice for Peace, are shareholders in Caterpillar, and every year at their shareholder meetings, we've been bringing resolutions about this. Last time around, Rachel Corey's parents spoke on our behalf, and that's gotten a fair amount of coverage in the business press. And the idea, this is really actually the first shareholder resolution around this issue, and we're hoping the first of many, because we would like to make it difficult for corporations to profit from the death and destruction over there. So anyway, so that's one of our campaigns, and one of the results of it is that the number of denominations are considering, for example, the Presbyterian Church has been in discussion about whether to divest from corporations like Caterpillar that benefit from the occupation. And so that's one of our campaigns. Another is we're challenging the kind of repression of, prevention of discussion that happens around this issue. There are very many venues where it's very difficult to have an open discussion.
Henry, let me interrupt you and frame that into a larger question, because that was going to be one of my questions. How is Jewish Voice for Peace perceived in the American Jewish community and in the Jewish press? Because normally they're very pro-Israel and are not very tolerant of critics, even Jewish critics. So go ahead with what you were saying. Sorry to interrupt.
The situation is complicated. Most Jews, like most Israelis, like most Palestinians, would like to see peace in the Middle East. Overwhelming majority of American Jews support a two-state solution. The polling done by the Jewish establishment shows that young Jews are more concerned about peace than they are about security. And the trend is for our views to become increasingly accepted. However, this is not without a fight. The current leadership of the Jewish community has worked very, very hard for a long time to portray any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic, and they have worked hard to prevent open discussion of these questions. For example, we had an event at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco 2-3 years ago, which attracted hundreds of people. We completely filled the place. It was a fundraiser and a tremendous success. Soon afterwards, we found that they had changed their rental rules to exclude us. We can no longer rent space there. This is just one example of many of the sorts of repression that happens. And here's another example that it's not about us, but because this, we're only one group. Other example, in Berkeley, California, there was an art gallery that received some City of Berkeley funding. They had an exhibit of art about Palestine, and it was an exhibit that was scheduled just like all their other art exhibits, based on it was judged according to artistic merit, and there was pressure put on the city to challenge the funding of this art gallery because of having had an exhibit of about Palestine. And Jewish Voice for Peace led a big letter writing campaign to the city council and the mayor in support of that art gallery, so that they would not be
Well, it does sound like a struggle. We have only, unfortunately, about 60 seconds left. And Jewish Voice for Peace is a membership organization. And I know here in Detroit, at least one man that's prominent in the group is a Gentile. Is this restricted to Jews, or can anyone be a member of it?
No, no, anyone can be a member. I mean, it's really, it's our main mission and goal is to be the voice of dissenting Jews around this issue. But, of course, you know, we welcome any help and support.
And I notice as well that you have a number of other projects, which this looks very interesting, that there's a JVP, Olive Harvest delegation that's going to Israel and Palestine in October of 2007. So it sounds like you are doing lots of work and entering the debate over this in a very positive way. I want to thank you very much for being with me. Again, my guest has been Henry Pacioto. He's chair of the board of Jewish Voice for Peace. You can go to jvp.org. I'll have a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Henry Pacioto, thanks so much for joining me on the program.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRIF.com.